right? Because we'll have a cross-section which tells us how, you know, cross-section is in Barnes, right? It says, hey, this looks like this big an object. And so you have to integrate it. So, okay, good. We get a probability here, which absolutely we can relate to the cross-section. And this isn't right. You got it right. I just got it wrong. And that this is twice the arctan of that. And then by setting this, the pi over 4, then we suppress, we minimize this. So all great. I want you to think about a couple more things. And the first is, if you want to make a measurement, then we want to say, well, what's the sensitivity of that measurement? And of course, we need a metric to compare a variety of experiments. And so we could fill the boards. We won't do that, but we could fill the boards with suggested experiments. We say, well, here's a measure that's going to tell me if this is the right one to do. And the measure is usually the contrast to noise. And this is a real problem, because this contrast is not the contrast we've been talking about with the interferometer. This contrast, so I put it in quotes here, says, what's the change in signal with our model? Okay, so here we say, oh yeah, I want some change in the signal. And of course, that's going to be with this piece, right? That's what you're varying. So I say, oh, well, okay, that's all right. I'll look at the intensity in the O beam for theta minus the intensity in the O beam for theta plus some small change. But of course, you need something more than that. You need to say, well, what's the noise in the measurement? And the noise in this measurement is going to be the square root of n, which is the number of counts. Now, we would actually modify that slightly. It would be the number of counts that contribute to the contrast. Now I'm using contrast as in the contrast of the interferometer, right? Because the counts, and in your model, you took that correctly into account. You said, oh, I want to set this to 0. And therefore, all the counts would contribute to the contrast. In reality, there'll be some dark counts. So you know, you would never be able to set this quite to 0. And of course, to see that noise comes in as a square root of the number of events, if we have some Poissonian distribution of events, that I hope you've seen before. You've all done a physics lab on photon counting, probably, and looked at the statistics. Yeah. If you haven't, MIT's website, which lists really complete descriptions of their junior year experiments, has a lovely write-up on how to calculate those statistics. So here's a measure of the goodness of this. And now if I plotted the contrast curve, so let's just say as a function of alpha, let's just think about some generic experiment, then we would tend to think that we should be sitting here. Because then the function that we're characterizing is varying quickly with the parameter that we're changing, as opposed to sitting here or here, where everything, of course, is going slowly. And so the precision of getting out a piece of information will be higher here. So I was wondering if I could convince you to think about this problem and to add that. There's another question I have with this is, would it be beneficial to move this to here? Now, in this case, you're doing this lovely thing. You say, ah, there's attenuation in this case, but by choosing the phases correctly, I can still keep a nice contrast. And so I can look at a coherent measurement of this. Alternatively, one could put it over here and say, ah, by the choice of this phase, I can control how much information I lose to that attenuation. And I don't know if you read Paul Quiot's paper. Did you? Yeah, okay. So I mean that's the approach that Paul takes. So, it's a great idea. It's the first time I've seen it. I'm gonna think about it some more. I would also like someone to give me a short Mathematica notebook on this. Because when we go and we get together and we talk about what experiment we should do, which we do, we get a community together. It happens quite regularly at National Labs. Because, time at National Labs is precious. You only have so many neutrons coming from your reactor. You like to use them all. And then when we talk about that, we always get down to brass tacks that, hey, here's the model. Here's the data we're going to get. This is going to be the quality of the data if we do it on this instrument. And this is how we're going to extract the information that we need. And we estimate this is the precision with which we'll know this. And so if you'll give me a Mathematica, then at some point I'll share the idea with my friends as we were thinking about doing experiments. And you will see that in the not too distant future, we'll have a precise measurement of helium-3 cross-section. Now, I want to also give you another tutorial problem. I hope it works for you to have, tutorial problems where there isn't a simple correct answer. That you've been physicists long enough that the simple correct stuff you can save for the GREs. So there's a new geometry of neutron interferometry experiments that we're going to set up where the neutrons come in this way, and what we're interested in is what comes out here as a function of the phase. And so we're going to vary this phase. And in this case, of course, you can see that what we want is we want reflection. And there's two ways you might think of analyzing this. One way is to say, oh, let me take a wave packet and stick it in there, and let me calculate the wave packets that come out. The other way of thinking about it is to say, oh, let me just think about this as a scattering problem, and I'll look at a stationary state over this ring. Okay? I think the second is a better way to look at it, but both of them, of course, will work. And so I want to ask you to look at this new geometry of an interferometer and tell us how sensitive we'll be able to measure that phase. I want to share with you before then, in this case, of course, we rely upon having two paths out as we go in. Here, we're going to get two paths at this point, but the rest of this, I really want to be reflectors. And you would say, well, how do you do that? And there's a lovely experiment that says, take a neutron spin. Let's make it spin up. And let's put the whole thing in a big magnetic field. I guess if I draw the spin that way, I'll put the field this way. Put it all in a big magnetic field. And then it's going to go through this material. And I'm going to arrange that it's at the wrong wavelength. It won't interact with that first blade. So it'll be transmitted. And then I'm going to put a coil here and I'm going to flip the spin state. So when I flip the spin state, now I've changed the momentum of that neutron. And now I've made it so that this neutron is going to reflect from this blade, right? So now it's going to go through Bragg scattering. Instead of being in the Lowy geometry, we're in the Bragg geometry. We're going to make reflection the most likely thing to happen. We do that by choice of angles, right? And then this is going to reflect back and forth until we change the spin state again, in which case it'll come out. So we can take two plates. In this case, they turn out to be graphite because I want to have a long wavelength. The wavelength here is about 9 angstroms. But we can keep a neutron trapped between these plates, bouncing back and forth for a long time. Of course, neutrons eventually decay. We don't keep them in there that long. But we can keep it in for a long time to do an experiment. And you can take the same idea and apply it here. We can take a neutron and we can put it inside here and we can keep it in there. We can keep it in there for as long as we want until we change the state. Yeah, so you have to decide when you want it to come out. Or, you know what I find a little bit more interesting is to say, let's make it so there's a small probability that it comes out. So we say, okay, I want it to mostly reflect, but let's give ourselves a 10% chance that it comes out. And then you get a nice continuous scattering here. You will. You will. It's difficult with neutrons to have a really, really good reflector unless the angles are very shallow. And so I don't think people have looked at it as a quantum memory. And it might be, you have to think about what would be the state, right? Because you're not going to use the spin state as the memory, right? So it has to be something to do with the neutron itself. You could encode in momentum. And you could encode in a wave packet. So there's some things that one could do. So I'm not sure. But people haven't done it yet. So propose an experiment to make it exciting enough that we want to do it. All right. So now then, I want to continue with our discussion about incoherence and decoherence and dephasing. And I want to remember the experiment we started off with, which was the neutron interferometry case, to imagine that the first blade really was perfect, so it creates an equal superposition. And then there's a phase, phi, that is a rotation about z. And then on top of that, we added a magnetic phase, just by adding a magnetic field. And because the spin state was in the identity state, then there were two options that if the spin was up or if the spin was down, it would go in those two different directions. And then if we measured the cross-section or the contrast as a function of this magnetic cross-section, so the contrast as a function of the field, then what we would see is that it would oscillate. And it oscillates because our distribution has only two elements in it. And now I wanted to go and I want to look a little bit more carefully. And we're going to come back to this discussion over and over and over again. Because if you want to do something quantum mechanical, coherence and the control of coherence is the most essential thing. You know, you can't say, oh, let's do something quantum mechanical, but let's throw away coherence, right? You're left with tunneling. And tunneling's great, but, you know, we're not going to build a quantum computer that way, I don't think. So what I want to do is to think about this. And, of course, there's a lot of different perspectives. There's a lot of different aspects of this. And you're going to hear that as we go over these few weeks. And you have the benefit that, you know, there's a couple of different perspectives. And that's good. Remember that what happens with quantum mechanics is, by and large, quantum mechanics is outside of our everyday existence. And if we talk about physics, just like we talk about any science, you know, we're not that far from Neanderthals sitting around a fire. We tell some story. And then afterwards, we tell some story, we go and we do the math and connect it. And the story we tell, of course, is a story that we hope is some shared experience. In quantum mechanics, up until the moment that you go into the lab or that you're comfortable with the math, you don't have that shared experience to draw on. And hopefully these simple experiments that we'll describe, you know, will help motivate some of that shared experience and to say, oh yes, actually quantum mechanics is part of our everyday existence, that, you know, we can picture this experiment just like somehow Feynman could picture his orange. And so what we're going to do is we'll have a set of stories, and you'll get different perspectives on the stories. But after the stories, when we write down the math, that's always going to be the same. You know, the stories might sound different, but, you know, this person took two paths through the woods. The math is all going to be the same. So here, when I think about incoherence, and I want to separate it from decoherence, what's important to me is a few things. One, that there's a distribution of Hamiltonians. And that this distribution is governed by a classical probability distribution. And the other piece that's important to me is that the distribution is static on the time scale of the experiment. Excuse me. And here, of course, we've got this neutron moving through our interferometer. It takes this ungodly long time of 10 microseconds to meander through. If the spin coherence time was short compared to 10 microseconds, so that state was fluctuating, then we wouldn't see this behavior. And that's a nice problem to work on. If you haven't seen that and you want another homework problem, you can say, oh, do this and treat that as random telegraph noise. And see that the signatures are going to change. And so we're going to build on this. And then, of course, we want to know, well, what also happens when those two are not the case. And as I speak today, I want to remind you that although we think of quantum mechanics as being outside of our experience, it need not be the case that there's a beautiful set of experiments that many people have proposed because your eye is a good photon detector. So if I take you and I sit you in a dark room and I force you to sit there, and I take away all your electronics for a few hours, then statistically, your eye can see one photon. And, at undergraduate colleges, students are abused by being forced to do this. You sit around in a circle, someone has a single photon detect source, and they randomly fire it, and someone says that they saw something or not. And then you correlate that. It's not a very high quantum efficiency detector, but statistically, you can see a single photon. And so there's ideas of, hey, could we do Bell measurement experiments using people? And then, of course, the next step would be, well, let's entangle them. It may be someday that quantum mechanics becomes a real internal piece of our lives, but we're not there yet. Okay, so let's talk about neutron interferometry and to try to get at this picture. And so now the experiment becomes this one. I'm going to take my neutron beam, and here I'm going to put a prism. And unfortunately, I don't draw it right because I'm looking down. So what I want to do is I want to show, if I look from this side, that in the beam, so if I look from this side, let me line it up, then we would have our three blades. They're connected to a common base, right? So that it really is one crystal. And we have the beam coming in, and I'm going to put a prism made out of silica here. So that the phase shift that I see is going to depend upon the height of the beam, right? And so if I take K to be the wave number, of this prism, then the phase is going to be K times the height is Z in our system, right? X, Y, Z. Okay, so now then we have a phase as we go up, and I haven't told you, but let me tell you now, that the beam that comes into the interferometer is about 1 centimeter high. Turns out to be about 1 centimeter by 2 millimeters. And the reason is, hey, we only get one neutron a second as it is. So if I said I was going to take this beam and look at a really small piece, then I would really have no neutrons, right? So we have this distributed beam. And this is nice, right? Because now we get our operator for the prism where we have this other value of our device, Z, right? We've introduced, a parameter. And you can see that the face gets wrapped up into a helix. So it's nicely associated with a wave number, right? It gets wrapped up nicely into a helix. And so after coming through this, I would have a helical phase along Z, and of course that distance would be 2 pi over k. Now this fits our model. It says, oh yeah, we have a classical distribution of Hamiltonians, and they're static, right? The Hamiltonians are defined by Z, they're static, and the distribution, well, the distribution becomes now not only the distribution of Hamiltonians, but of course, the distribution over the input state. And so now then I would say, oh yes, what do I have? I have rho that's a function of Z, and I want to integrate the probability that I have that so, although I have, you know, a nice unitary dynamic over each and every piece, we wrap this up into a phase. And actually, if I could have the board. Yeah, thanks. Now, I didn't tell you here that if you want to calculate this, for silica, 2 pi corresponds to about 40 microns. So we can say what K is given any shape of a prism. Oh, I lost my chance. So with this piece, what are we going to find? We're going to find and I'm going to add a piece here. I'm going to vary the pitch of that prism. So as we do our measurement out here, and I look at I, I'm going to look at the intensity in the O-beam as a function of K. And the way we do this is we take two prisms back to back, and we rotate them relative to each other, so that we go from something that looks like a trapezoid or square to something that looks like a prism. So we can have a continuous variation on the pitch. And if I have nothing in this blade, in this beam, and of course I integrate over this, and that's the operation, then it's going to look like a Fourier transform, right? And so what I'll get out here is I'll get out the Fourier components. Of the beam. And let's leave it like that for a second. And since the beam is going to be rectangular, the Fourier transform of a rectangle is a sinc function, right? So the intensity as a function of K, and of course K can be positive and negative, then I'll get out a sinc function modulation of this. So sine kx over sine ka over k, and this will fall off as 1 over k, right? Okay. Well, I'm glad it's you and not me. I would be in the same boat. Now, we developed this idea because we wanted to put a sample here and to be able to get a coherent image. And so in the notes, you can look at that. If I take a sample here, then of course this Fourier transform becomes not the Fourier component of the beam, but it becomes the Fourier component of the beam as modified by this sample. And so then I get out beam modified by the sample. So then when I take a Fourier transform, if I plot here as phase of the sample as a function of z, then I'll get the intensity here will give me that phase information. And so I'll directly be able to measure the shape of that sample, provided the sample is uniform and such things. And the nice piece is to say, look, So I don't think it's set yet, right? Because the lights have to go down for this to be working. Oh, there we go. Maybe there we go. Oh yeah. We're good. So here. Although the detector is integrating over the whole sample, right? The detector itself contains no spatial information. Then because I'm looking at the beating of these two gratings with each other, I can extract spatial information, and I can extract it at any wave function, at any length scale that I want. And so I can recombine the data. Okay, so there's our experiment, and we calculate all that stuff, and here, let me go down, I'll come back to that. Here is the data from the O and H beam as I scan the pitch of that prism, okay? And of course, the pitch is zero there. And so we've set the neutrons to be in one beam, in one path. And as I vary that, then of course, what we see is the sync function, and there's a little bit of a phase shift as well that we see. So the other beam is not zero. But you can see the beatings of that. Now, if I looked at the beam coming out of the detector, so we've said that we had this big beam. And so I could say, well, let me take away the helium-3 detector and let me put in a position-sensitive detector. And I can put in a position-sensitive detector by using bismuth followed by a CCD. And so bismuth is going to convert a neutron into a photon, and then a CCD will detect it. Now it's a bit miserable because bismuth has a low conversion efficiency and your CCD doesn't have great resolution, but having said all that, this is of course what you'd expect is that, oh, in the notes, I converted K to Q. That as I increase Q, the wave number, then you see these stripes. It's a question for the students as to why they're tilted. It's an easy answer, but I'll let you figure it out. And if I look at the two detectors, they're out of phase with each other. Of course, if I look experimentally, then this is what I see. I see the tilt, I see this periodic modulation, I see that there's some noise in this. So you can believe me, it's real data. And this is a nice picture where I look at the two beams, and of course the gratings that come at the two detectors must be complementary to each other, right? If a neutron doesn't arrive at one detector, it better arrive at the other detector. And that, of course, is what you see. Now, for me, the fact that I get a sync function and that I can associate this with the probability, I say, okay, this phase is something I can control. Now, of course, if I just go back and I look at the helium-3 detector, that's here. So this is a plot of an additional phase I put in, a phase flag, Q or K, and the intensity. And you can see that what happens is that if the wave number is zero, then I see the modulation due to the additional phase flag. And that as I increase that, what happens is I lose that modulation. It goes to just one half. And as I increase Q, of course, this is not like the magnetic detection. You're going to lose. You never get it back, right? You see these small oscillations, but otherwise it falls off as 1 over Q. And if you look carefully in the data, you can see that the small oscillations are there as well, right? So all of that works nicely. Now, the other piece that, of course, I want to keep in mind is that we can control this. And so if I place another prism in there so that now I have the same phase in both paths, then I had better remove this effect, right? So I better show that, in fact, under this circumstance, we will only see a contrast. So if I turn up this prism, and then I put another prism here, so K and K prime, when K and K prime are equal, then it's as though I have no prisms here, and I would only see a phase flag that I would put in there, and I would get full contrast. And so it says, oh yes, this of course is static and perfectly controllable. And that of course works. It works experimentally. It works in theory, it works experimentally.
Is there any difference between the prisms and the phase flag?
Right, so that's the difference. That for the phase flag is going to operate consistently across the beam. But for the prisms, then the amount of phase you write depends upon the height of your particle within this beam.
So if you maintain a minimum of time, you would maintain the phase flag.
That's right. But if you know the problem is, we'll look at that. If the beam is really, really tiny, what's going to happen is we won't collect any neutrons. And I can say it now. Because the neutron interferometer is so sensitive to everything, it's sensitive to a thousandth of a degree change in temperature. It's sensitive to you walking by it. It's sensitive, as I said, to the moon rising. It's sensitive to the pressure. To atmospheric pressure, and of course, to every vibration, every acoustic noise imaginable. So, the people at NIST, they said, oh, no, it's sensitive to all these things. We need to shield it. So they built a beautiful room that I show you in the first lecture notes that has vibration isolation, acoustic isolation, temperature control, and they do this by building a room inside a room inside a room inside a room. And each of those, you add big concrete or marble slabs. Each of those, you add vibration equipment. Each of those, you add temperature stability. And they make this huge setup that really excludes all vibrational noise, all noise, it's environmental noise. It's great. Except it takes up a lot of real estate. And so in order to make this, they had to move the experiment away from the source. And, you know, the neutron source, it looks like a point source. So the further away you go, the less neutrons you have. And so finally they end up with this beautiful, environmentally clean piece that if there was any neutrons there, you could make a great measurement. So now I want to talk about this piece. So what we're going to do now is say, okay, we have this structure. We know that we're sensitive to changes. We know that we can control it. Oh, I'm sorry, I want that. Don't go away. That's like having Microsoft, right? You know, it knows what you want to do. And the challenge we have in building a neutron interferometer is we machine these blades. So we have a blade, and we machine it. And we've said that 40 microns gives us a pi phase shift. So I want the surface of the blade to be really, really smooth. And I'll tell you how we do that. But historically, they haven't been really, really smooth. And so what happens is you have some roughness here. And so that roughness, of course, is adding a random phase. It's random because your position of the neutron in the beam is random. You know, if you could put the neutron exactly the same place again, it would get exactly the same phase. But each of these surfaces has a random phase just because of the machining of this. So we have our neutron beam coming in. And we have it like so. And we've said that this blade is a pi over 2 rotation about y. That this is a pi rotation about y. That this is a pi over 2 rotation about y. And that this is a phi rotation about z. And over here, we're detecting mz equals to plus 1/2. And here, mz is equal to minus 1/2. Right? That's our neutron interferometer. Now let's go through and let's look about what we're going to treat this noise. The noise on this side of the blade, do I need to worry about it? Okay, let me put it differently. I don't need to worry about it. Why? So the noise is a phase shift, right? So the noise is always going to show up as some stochastic variable about the z-axis. So why don't I need to worry about it here? Yeah?
Gets the every incoming move come in every path since there's only one path at that point.
I like the piece where you say there's only one path. Okay? So the neutron beam is still big. So they're going to see the variations. But it's only one path. Yes, that's exactly true. I'm trying to get you to say involves the word commutator. Or you could use an eigenstate.
The noise operator commutes with the measurement.
Absolutely. So the noise operator here commutes with the input state. And therefore, that surface we don't need to be so careful about. And if we come over here, well, we're measuring along Z. That surface I don't need to be so careful about. And then let's look here. This noise and this noise. Well, the only operator I have in between is the sigma Z operator. And these are sigma Z, right? So the total of this is going to be that I have the phase total will equal the phase of the phase flag plus the phase of noise on one beam plus the phase of noise on the second blade. And of course, we'll add those up as we'll add up random events, right? So just like a stochastic number. So far, I only need one number here, and I need one number here. Now, what about for the middle blade? Can I add those two? You know, it's a really nice operation, this pi rotation. Right? Because a pi rotation is going to carry sigma z to sigma z. So what's going to carry sigma z to minus sigma z? We're adding random variables. So we're not going to care about the sign. So I can add those two noise. Again, I have to add them as stochastic variables. But in fact, I only need, if I'm modeling this, to consider one noise parameter. Because at the end of the day, it's always going to add. In other words, if I take U noise on the first piece, and I multiply it by U of the middle blade, and then I multiply it by U noise on the second piece, that this thing is going to look like U middle, U noise 1, U noise 2. But I would have a negative sign here. Let's say if I call that alpha and beta. Wrong place. Alpha and beta. But they're random variables. I don't care about the sign. So everything works out for me. Yeah? And so then these two, of course, have the same functional form. And so I get just one noise operation at, let's call it the square root of 2 times alpha, which is just the width, right? Don't get too tied up with that. So now then we have a simple model. And we say, well, what does the noise look like? Well, I mean, we really do our best to get rid of any noise. So whatever is left, we'll just say that it's Gaussian. So we have a Gaussian distribution. And now, if I could get this back. And the other reason, of course, to choose Gaussian is anytime I have something random and I need to do an integral, we can all integrate to Gaussian probability distribution. So then we say, oh, well, there must be Gaussian because then I don't have to think about the integral. We're going to force everyone to bring their own laptop to class. Room will turn off. That's bad. So remember what we were trying to do. We said that we have this neutron interferometer. And when we look at the contrast curve, which we've measured experimentally, then we see that if the ideal contrast curve is like this, that we see something let me try to draw it correctly. We see something like that, that it doesn't go quite to one, it doesn't go quite to zero, and it rather accidentally meets somewhere. And remember what would happen. We have now two knobs to turn. Okay, I don't have two knobs to turn. There's the one knob that says, tell me what the transmission reflection coefficient is. And if I was turning the transmission reflection coefficient, that what would happen is I would go from having this curve to having a set of curves that would eventually go to one. Right, but if I was only changing the transmission reflection coefficient, then this path would eventually go to one, and the other path would eventually go to zero. Right, but they would never move away from that. And of course, if we add noise, well, we already saw that with the magnetic prisms, right? If we added noise, what happens is that the contrast curves both go to 1/2. And so now then, we've got both of these events going on. Okay. Yes, the projector is on. If we could get it's so that it would show something up here. And given these two parameters, we can now uniquely find what the noise is in the interferometer and what the transmission coefficients are. And if you look at the CDF files, it'll show you that. And our way of solving this problem now is there's a neat new tool that was developed for making triggers for nuclear weapons. If you make a trigger for a nuclear weapon, you want things to come together smoothly and precisely. And so what they did is they took one big diamond and they machined surfaces with one facet of one diamond about 10 nanometers at a time. And, you know, if you're patient, you can get a really smooth surface. You can machine a mirrored surface. And so we've bought one of these tools that will cut over, they'll cut a piece of silicon over a 10 centimeter length. It will have a roughness which is less than 5 nanometers, and it will be out of true by less than 20 nanometers. So it just is an amazingly precise piece that gets that precision by saying, oh, I'm only to cut with one little facet of one diamond. It's not like the normal cutters where, of course, you would have a diamond powder and you would be cutting faster. And so if you're, you know, patient to do this, and the tools are no longer, well, I have no idea whether they're used for nuclear weapons anymore, but they're sold now for making molds for contact lenses. For reasons I don't understand, you have to have the mold really smooth for a contact lens, or the contact lens will tear as you try to remove it. And so they have these tools which you can buy from two companies that are across the street from each other in Vermont. If you want to have a bitter conflict, you should put your company right across the street from your competitor. They'll be able to do this. And so sometime in the next couple of months, we'll have this tool and we can start machining it. So I'll leave you, unfortunately, to look at the CDF file and we'll start from there. And I hope that with the tutorials, that we'll continue along this way of having open-ended questions. I hope that that's fun and rewarding. And for the noise, the piece that I wanted to get at, which I really haven't said, is with this case where we have the surface roughness. Now, of course, this is a fixed error in phase. It shows up with an exponential decay in the contrast as I would put more and more blades. Okay, so it shows up with everything that we would say is incoherence. And we have this piece where we say, oh yeah, we know the probability distribution over this, right? So it's bloody static in time, right? So this looks like incoherence in search of a way to control it, right? There's the information is there if only you could access it. And of course, in some ways we can, because we can say, oh, I'm going to replace my helium-3 detector with a position-sensitive detector, and then I would see that for each of the individual paths, there actually is contrast. But they would have to be very, very small. Okay? So we'll stop there, and we'll keep having this conversation about what's incoherence, what's decoherence, and how do we control it. It's important to me for incoherence that the set of Hamiltonians is governed by a classical probability distribution. So I'm not sure. That's almost the same thing, I think, right?
And so you would only choose to use this model because you don't have the
computer power. I'm gonna push back on this in principle. Okay? And if I had a quantum computer, I couldn't solve this problem any better. Right? A quantum computer wouldn't help me understand the surface imperfections that came out of the milling machine. If I had a position-sensitive detector with perfect quantum efficiency and a point spread function that was a delta function, then we wouldn't be having this conversation. I've got to run to another meeting.